Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. We volunteers at KBOO are so thankful that the station is continuing to provide relevant information and wonderful music to help us maintain through this pandemic, and we're sure you share our feelings. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, KBOO has had to cancel our spring pledge drive. But you can still help us through these difficult times. Please consider becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you already are a member by going to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. The COVID-19 pandemic is stretching how we need to think in so many ways, economically, socially, medically, and spiritually. Today we talk with Richard Heinberg, Senior Fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute, about how the coronavirus pandemic provides both opportunities and challenges for creating a sustainable future, as it reminds us that we are vulnerable biological organisms in Earth's web of life. In the face of disaster capitalist predators, how do we build a new culture and society that sustains life for everyone on the planet, human and non-human alike? Richard, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's very good to be with you again, Barbara.
I was reading some of your articles last night that you've been writing about COVID I was reading ones from April and I think early May. And one of the things that struck me is how much has changed so quickly since you wrote these articles. I mean, one of them was only maybe 3 weeks old. And I just wanted to start by talking about how time has been so altered by this pandemic.
Yeah, I know. I think for everyone, it's like BP and AP, you know, before pandemic and after pandemic. And even our sense of the future is altered because nobody knows when this is going away or if it's going away or how it's going away. It's like we're in this waiting room or this, you know, purgatory. It's very eerie and strange, and nobody knows quite what to do with it in their heads.
Yeah, I was having this thought as I was lying awake at 2 o'clock in the morning, which I think a lot of people I know are doing these days. And I was thinking about this unknowing and how disconcerting it is. And then I slipped into this moment where I felt really at peace with it because I realized it's really about being in the present. And there was this weird feeling I got where I thought, I'm going to miss this when this is over, of not worrying so much about the future. I mean, well, we worry about it, but not being so oriented towards the future. And it makes me think of some of the stuff that you were writing about the ways that our heads are changing and the ways that our psyches are changing as we're dealing with this.
And, you know, you go outside and there's not as much traffic and the sky is clearer. And, you know, if you're fortunate, as I guess I am, to be in a situation where you're not struggling to pay rent or something like that, it actually feels pretty good in some ways, not in others. I mean, I'm a musician. I play a string instrument, and I love to play chamber music. And I haven't gotten together with any of my musician friends in a couple of months, and I really miss that. You know, just the human contact is really a really big hole in not just my life, but I think everyone's life these days.
Well, periodically I think about the things that I really miss. And one of the things on the top of the list, besides just like being able to hang out with my friends from less than 6 feet away, is going down to KBOO every week to do this show, because I've been doing it from my house for now. I think I'm on 10 weeks in my home studio. And as much as I've kind of gotten into the groove of doing it at home, and it gets me some advantages of actually not doing it at the station, I realized how much I miss the interaction of coming in and saying hi to the receptionist and seeing my engineer. So it makes me think a lot about someone like me and you, who we're very privileged. And so the things that we're missing are not the things that are a matter of life and death. And
right.
One of the things, I mean, and you write about that in your articles too, about the people who aren't so lucky and how this is becoming a big divide. So let's talk a little bit about how we who live with backyards and beautiful gardens and a place to go walking outside and work at home and don't have to worry about paying off our mortgage or paying our rent. How do we connect with people for whom they have a very different reality with this pandemic?
One of the ways we interact with them is just in like going shopping at the grocery store. We're understanding now that these people are doing essential jobs. I mean, they're the ones who stand between us and basically starvation. And yet they're not getting paid very much and they're in harm's way. I mean, going to shop at the grocery store is not particularly dangerous per se. But working in a grocery store, your chance of exposure to the virus is much, much higher. So these folks are putting themselves at risk. And of course, there's all the healthcare workers, some of whom, you know, are paid decently and some, you know, are pretty marginal jobs, actually, in support positions. We really should be, I think, reordering our priorities in this country about, you know, who's important, who's essential, and who's not. Tragically, that hasn't been happening as much as it should. So, I mean, the obvious example is the stock market is, you know, almost at record levels right now. What the hell is going on with that? I mean, mass unemployment, companies are going bankrupt, profit levels are, you know, through the floor, and yet the stock market is so far up. The only explanation for that is that the Federal Reserve has bailed out the investor class with trillions of dollars. Now, sure, you know, the average person has maybe gotten a little payment from the government, you know, $1,200 or something, but it's nothing compared to what the people on with big investments on Wall Street have been reaping during all this time. And you know, it just ain't fair. It ain't fair. And it that's going to come home to roost at some point. I don't know when, but it can't be soon enough as far as I'm concerned.
Well, getting back to the frontline workers in the grocery store, I think that that's one place where we can actually do solidarity with them. I stop at a store that's in my neighborhood. It's been there for 20 years. I'm friends with a lot of people who work there. So I have a kind of personal connection. And one of the things that I started appreciating, it took them a little while to figure out how to deal with really safely running the store, both for the customers and for the workers. But I think they figured it out, and I feel very comfortable going there. But there's a Kroger's, well, it's QFC, but it's owned by Kroger, that's down at the other end of the neighborhood. It doesn't feel right to me. But then I learned that Kroger's is stopped paying hazard pay to their workers. And I have gone to the other Kroger's in Portland, which is Fred Meyer's. I've been there a couple times, and I felt like it was just not safe for the workers or for the customers. So I feel very strongly about it. I'm very selective now about where I'm going shopping, and that I'm shopping at stores where I know that they're taking care of their workers. And I think that's one of the things we can think of where maybe we're not going out to demonstrations right now, which may be signing a lot of online petitions, but where we choose to shop really is a very strong political statement.
And local restaurants, you know, New York Times had an article a few weeks ago suggesting that up to 70% of local restaurants could be going under as a result of the pandemic. And our communities just can't afford to lose, you know, all of these local businesses. So, you know, going out to get takeout from local restaurants, I mean, it's a on one hand, it might just be seen as a convenience, but on the other hand, it's a way of helping these folks stay in business. And so, you know, restaurants whose, as you say, business practices you particularly like, you know, like use local food and organically grown food and treat their workers well, you know, this is a time to step up and support them.
In the beginning of the pandemic, I was very nervous about getting takeout, and I have many conversations with friends about whether it seemed like it was safer to have dinner with your friends eating 6 feet apart than it was to go to a restaurant and do takeout. I think one of the things that's made me feel a little bit more comfortable is the science that's been coming out lately, that the virus really doesn't live very long on very many surfaces. And so I don't have to worry about that paper bag that the food is coming in when I pick it up at the restaurant. But a couple weeks ago, we started going out for takeout, and I was thinking about some of the restaurants in our neighborhood that I feel like I really want to support. So it is, again, a way to support these restaurants. And now with my friends, we're thinking about more and more places that we can do this and to start going out maybe on the same time schedule that we used to go out to dine in. And now that some of the counties in Oregon are opening again and some of the restaurants are opening, they're talking about the sidewalks and maybe even some streets be set up for dining. So how do you see that we can maybe adapt to this new reality and maybe bring businesses, particularly local businesses, back on their feet again?
It's happening gradually and haltingly. I know here in California, where I live, we're going through stages, as pretty much everybody is, I think. And the stage we're in right now for California and Sonoma County is right at the edge of opening up restaurants. So as you say, you can do, as long as you're outside dining, it's fine, but no dining in. And within the next week or two, they'll allow people to go inside and dine, but you'll have to be further apart, fewer people in the restaurant, which means lower profits for the restaurant, fewer people needing to work, fewer people getting paid, and so on. You know, this is going to take a while to get back to anything like what we think of as normal, and there are very likely to be some hiccups along the way. We did flatten the curve in terms of transmission rate and deaths and so on, but we didn't squash the curve like they've done in New Zealand and Australia and Taiwan and Korea, South Korea, and places like that. So there's a very strong chance that as we open up, we'll see rebounds in infection rates and hopefully not deaths, but entirely possible. And we may have to retrench a bit on these rules. So it's kind of tragic that our country has responded so poorly. We've had such poor national leadership, I have to say. Some of the states have had decent leadership, but nationally, it's been, I think, you know, tragically inept. And future generations will look back, and I think they'll say this was a pivotal point in American history when this global empire that sat atop the world economy and called the shots in international meetings and so on, really started to lose it. And I would guess that a few years from now, America is no longer going to be in anything like the position of, you know, global superpower that we have prided ourselves on being for the last several decades.
Well, I'm thinking it's kind of ironic that this country started out by bringing the plague to the indigenous people who lived here and just wiping out, like, 90% of most of the indigenous populations, particularly in the West. And now we are being hit by this plague, which feels to me in a way is in part being undone by our own arrogance and our inability to look at science.
We've set up a whole series of catastrophes that could have been the trigger for the unraveling of empire. From climate change to, you know, the global debt bubble and all the way on extreme inequality and rising inequality. That's never good for the life of a civilization. And who would have guessed that it would be, you know, a tiny bug that even a powerful optical microscope can't see that would be our undoing? But, you know, that in combination with Donald Trump is a pretty powerful blow. If it had happened, you know, even during Obama's tenure, I think the federal response would have been, you know, far different. We'd be in a different situation. Not that I agreed with everything Obama did, but, you know, just sheer incompetence and mean-spiritedness at the federal level now has real effects. I mean, obviously, there are lots of reasons to loathe what the Trump administration has been doing with environmental regulations and immigrants and all kinds of things. But, you know, when a disaster comes along, this scale of disaster comes along, and you don't have decent leadership, and instead you have a leader whose main strategy is to divide the country on every possible issue, this is not going to end well. I mean, even wearing face masks has become a tribal badge now. This is not a mark of a successful country.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cebu Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Richard Heinberg, who's a senior fellow with the Post Carbon Institute. And we're going to get into now, I think, the gist of what we want to talk about, which is how the coronavirus pandemic has provided both opportunities and challenges for creating a sustainable future. Because you've been writing, Richard, about how to clearly and truly create a sustainable future, which means having to change a lot more things than a lot of people probably want to change. How is this pandemic actually making us look at how maybe possible and necessary some of the changes that you've been hearkening for really are?
looking at a sustainable future, one of the key changes we have to make is getting off of fossil fuels. Pretty much everybody knows that. I mean, that's at the core of dealing with climate change. And up to this point, there very little has actually happened. I mean, yeah, we've built some more solar panels and wind turbines, but they've just been sort of add-ons to the fossil fuel regime that has continued to grow. I mean, consumption of fossil fuels, it's so immense, you know, 85% of our energy. If it grows only like 2% per year, that overwhelms the additions of solar panels and wind turbines. Even if they're growing at, you know, 16 or 20% per year, that's not enough to overtake the energy growth from fossil fuels because it's starting at such a huge advantage. Not much is happening, and political leaders around the world have been dragging their feet because they want to preserve economic growth as their first priority. You know, that's the important thing. And then if we can forestall climate change, that's nice too. But it's not as important as growing the economy. The coronavirus pandemic is now forcing a shift in priorities. I mean, suddenly growing the economy is not our first priority. Our first priority is protecting the health of citizens. You know, shutting down the economy is okay if it keeps the health system from being overwhelmed and if it saves, you know, thousands of lives, then we're willing to do that. You know, even though if you look at the pandemic versus climate change and ultimately, you know, which is going to be more devastating for people and planet, well, clearly it's climate change, but we haven't been willing to take the necessary measures because up to this point, because they conflicted with the goal of economic growth. Well, now that excuse has fallen away. You know, I mean, since the pandemic happened, global carbon emissions have plummeted far more than they have as a result of anything governments have done proactively. The skies are clearer, you know, carbon emissions are down. It'll be months before we know the exact number, but probably, you know, 10% or more. That's extraordinary. Well, you know, if we didn't know how to get carbon emissions down before, we certainly do now.
Don't drive.
Yeah, exactly. Don't drive. Before there was the problem. Oh, the aviation industry. How do we transition aviation to a post-fossil fuel future? Nobody could figure it out. I mean, maybe with sophisticated biofuels, maybe with some electric aircraft with huge, heavy batteries, maybe, you know, with hydrogen-powered airliners. But all of those ideas were, you know, just on the wish list drawing boards of the aircraft industry, because all of them would be way more expensive than the current kerosene-burning airliners. But, well, we dealt with that problem from a climate perspective. We just grounded the whole aviation industry, or 90% of it. And as a result, we're not spewing all of those carbon emissions into the stratosphere. So it is possible to deal with climate change. We've just found a particularly uncomfortable way of doing it. I mean, we could achieve the same result using proactive measures. But the key is we are going to have to take a hit on economic growth. I mean, that's the reality. And it's time that policymakers realized that and had the courage to stand up and explain that to the people of their countries and of the world. Just as they're having to stand up and explain their response to the coronavirus, you know, this is hard, this is tough, people are losing their jobs, but we're all in this together. And if we all sacrifice and make sure that we do it fairly, then we can get through this together and we'll have a better future. That's what we've said with regard to the pandemic, and that should be the message with regard to climate change, too.
Well, one of the sad what-ifs that I look at is when the second stimulus bill was being passed, and the House Democrats were insisting on having a plank in it that basically required the airline industry, if they were going to get any government subsidies, that they had to start the transition to green fuel, to sustainable fuel, and to get off of fossil fuel. Now, if we had had a totally enlightened government, because this was even moderate Democrats were going along with this, but of course, Republicans wouldn't hear anything of that. And so that plank was thrown out. And that's the kind of stuff that makes me feel really sad, because I keep thinking, on the one hand, a lot of people are coming up with some really creative ideas of how to move forward from this very unusual, strange, and difficult time. And then there's other people that just keep throwing up the roadblocks. So I just wonder how we get together to try to push past the obstacles that are being thrown up by Republicans and big business and Charles Koch and all the other forces that are aligned.
Well, if I had an answer for that. Yeah, well, I mean, we just have to keep doing what we're doing and improving our messaging all the time and reaching out to people who disagree with us and so on. There's no magic pill that's going to change everyone's mind. And the tragedy is that all of this is converging. The pandemic, climate change, and all the rest, all of that's converging at a moment in American history when we happen to be very polarized and divided, and that's a real tragedy, and that makes me very sad to think about, because if people are trusting one another and united and trusting their government, there's a lot they can do. I mean, look at what Britain did during World War II. Rationing is something that we will need in order to transition to a fossil fuel-free future. We're going to have to ration energy and lots of other things as we share the sacrifice to get to a different way of life. But as long as, one group of people says, oh, gee, we may have to cut back on something, and the other side says, oh, no, 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 we're never going to do that, then it really makes it hard to imagine how we're going to get through this as a cohesive society. I think it's entirely possible that the U.S. could come apart in the next months or years as a result of polarization, because it's just not a functional society as it is.
Well, I've been looking at other countries' responses, and I mean, there's New Zealand, which I was just talking with a friend earlier today about how we both wished we lived in New Zealand, but of course we can't go there yet because they're not letting anybody in.
They don't want Americans to come in.
They don't want Americans, for sure. And they're very smart that they're maintaining the quarantine. But just watching everything that's come out of New Zealand, and I've been admiring their prime minister for quite a while now, it's just a model of how you go forward, whether it's the earthquakes that they had, whether it was the mass murder, or whether it's whether they're dealing with the pandemic. But even like you mentioned in one of your articles about Denmark, let's talk about what Denmark did. Rather than having paycheck protection, what did Denmark do?
Denmark just paid companies to keep everyone on their payroll, and so that's going to make it much easier for the country to recover. Everyone will still have a job when they come out of this, as opposed to what the U.S. did with just handing out checks to everyone, and meanwhile. A lot of people are losing their jobs. Just enormous numbers of people are losing their jobs, and they may or may not get them back at the end of the day. So it's going to be much more traumatic for the U.S. than Denmark as a result of that.
Well, even the Paycheck Protection Plan, which on some level sounded good, which was that businesses, and it was supposed to be small businesses, could get these loans, which they could not have to pay back if they hired back their workers and they kept them working. And even if they didn't keep them working, they kept paying them. And it sounded like a great plan. But first of all, they spent all the money right away, mostly giving it to these large corporations that were pretending they had these individual businesses that were getting lots and lots of money. The time frame, I guess I learned just the other day, it was only 8 weeks. They had 8 weeks to pay back the loan. And I was listening to some small business owner was saying, 8 weeks is nothing. We can't even begin in 8 weeks. And so now they're talking about extending it to 16 more weeks. But still, keeping these deadlines seems to be very unrealistic when you're looking in the face of what we don't know is going to happen with the virus.
True.
I guess feel there's just all these lost opportunities. But I do want to talk about some of the ideas that are actually getting more mainstream, like Medicare for All. I mean, the whole idea that people deserve health care, it's a right, not a privilege, as the right's always saying, it's a privilege, not a right. Do you think that we've made some real headway in popularizing the idea that everybody needs health care and the government should pay for it?
Well, I think so, because it's clear that, public health is a priority for society as a whole. You know, if especially in a pandemic, you can't afford to give treatment only to people who can afford to pay for it, because that means you end up having a large portion of society that is not cared for and therefore is infecting everybody else. You know, it's just in everybody's interest that the whole society be taken care of in terms of health care. Never has that principle been so clearly underlined by stark experience as in what's going on now. But I would go further. As I've sort of implied in our discussion so far, you know, economic growth is something that's so 20th century. It's just not the reality of the future that we're facing globally with climate change and the need to transition away from fossil fuels. There are a lot of people who have actually been thinking about this for a long time, post-growth economists. Some of them call themselves steady-state economists. Some are called degrowth economists. Anyway, they've come up with a whole series of proposals for ways to ease the transition away from, you know, our century of rapid economic growth toward a new century of economic stasis or contraction, managed contraction. And a lot of these things make total sense in light of what we're going through now, like universal basic income. We're basically putting the toe in the water nationally with regard to that, with the payments that were sent out to virtually everyone, $1,200 a person. But that was a one-off. The idea of universal basic income is we provide everyone with a minimum survival standard, and then those who can and want to do more, contribute and earn more. Okay, fine. That makes sense in a post-growth society where the economy is contracting, but you want to contract the economy in a way where everyone is taken care of, at least at a basic level, universal basic income. Another one is getting away from measuring the economy just in terms of GDP, you know, the amount of money that's flowing through the economy. And, well, China has set aside its GDP target for the first time. China's, you know, in the last number of years, it's had growth targets of 7% or 6% or 5%. You know, 7% annual growth, what does that actually imply? It implies the doubling of the size of the economy every 10 years, using twice as much coal on an annual basis 10 years from now as China is currently doing. That's crazy. Economic growth can't go on forever on a finite planet. So we got to start making other plans. But if we get off of GDP as a be-all and end-all way of measuring a successful economy, what do you use instead? Well, there have been several proposals along the way. One of them is gross national happiness, which the little Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan has been using since the 1970s. And they found a pretty comprehensive way of measuring people's happiness and then designing their economy to maximize happiness rather than GDP growth. Well, what's the relevance of that for the present moment? Clearly, a lot of people are scared and unhappy with the coronavirus pandemic, and it's just not possible to optimize the economy for GDP growth under current circumstances. We do want to keep as many people employed as possible, but you know, I mean, everybody agrees that basically the U.S. is in a new depression, and GDP is plummeting like a stone. So rather than aiming for GDP growth, we should be aiming for, you know, keeping people healthy and happy as our first priority, and using the statistics and the measurement tools and whatever else can help us to, you know, envision and attain that goal. You know, it's a completely different way of organizing the economy. It's a post-growth economic, you know, system. And that's what we should be aiming for.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Richard Heinberg, who's a senior fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute, about how the coronavirus pandemic provides both opportunities and challenges for creating a sustainable future. Well, some people would ask, how are you going to pay for this if we're not growing all the time?
The post-growth economists have an answer for that, too, and it's called modern monetary theory. It turns out that countries that have monetary sovereignty, that is, they are capable of creating and managing their own currency, which includes the United States and Japan and a number of other countries. There's nothing to stop them from creating money for whatever projects they want. It doesn't necessarily entail the government going into debt and having to pay interest to investors for time immemorial. The money can just simply be created. I mean, the way money is created now, it's mostly created through people taking out loans at commercial banks. You know, you go into the bank, and if they approve you for a loan for $10,000, they don't just, you know, hunt around in the safe and find $10,000 that somebody else deposited there. They just credit your account with $10,000 that didn't exist a nanosecond previous to making that computer keystroke. Well, okay, if that's the case, then why can't we do that at the national level, which is exactly really what the Federal Reserve is doing in bailing out investors. It's, when in 2009, when the Fed was bailing out investors, the last couple of months when Fed has been bailing out investors, again, they're not issuing bonds and taking money from one pile to put it in another pile. They're just creating the money out of nothing and crediting accounts. So, we need a Green New Deal. Why not just pay for it that way? Now, the objection that always comes up, of course, is what about hyperinflation? Because there are lots of instances in history where governments have used similar mechanisms to inflate the currency and inflate away their debt. And the result has been, you know, that currency has lost its value, and sometimes to, you know, just absurd degrees. I have in my filing cabinet here, I have a $1 trillion bill issued by the government of Zimbabwe. You know, it's worth pennies as a souvenir.
Yeah, I have a bunch of bolivars in my desk drawer, actually, from 2006.
Right. So we don't want that to happen. But, you know, the post-growth economists have looked into ways of keeping that from happening and using taxation and other mechanisms. And it certainly can be done by a responsible government. But, you know, it's not as though a Green New Deal could not be paid for. Now, here's the thing. Money is not the same thing as energy and materials and goods. It's a claim upon energy and materials and goods. So if you're increasing the money supply, but you don't want to increase the rate at which you're using energy and natural resources, then you've got an imbalance there, and you've got to somehow keep those in sync. Otherwise, you do get hyperinflation at some point. And that's the tricky bit that would need to be negotiated with regard to modern monetary theory.
One of the concerns that I've heard from some people, particularly on the left, is a fear, basically to quote Naomi Klein, of the disaster capitalists moving in and taking advantage of this. And I've read some rather dire predictions of how this is going to happen, as it always happens, and using Hurricane Katrina as an example. And actually, there was an article that I was reading the other day about how probably the third quarter is going to come booming back, just as Trump has predicted, because things are going to start looking better, and there'll be a dip in the virus load, and so everything will just come roaring back. I'm not sure that I actually think that that's as likely as this particular author did, but it does make me concerned that there are predatory capitalists who are waiting to just dive in. And the other thing that I'm thinking, this isn't a small thing, but the plastic industry, which has been under attack for quite a while, and they've been trying to do all kinds of things to promote plastic as sustainable or whatever else, they're recyclable and all that stuff. And a lot of places like Oregon, California, Washington have single-use plastic bag bans now. Well, since the virus has struck, we can't use reusable bags at the supermarket, and so we're using more paper in Oregon. I'm finding that for health reasons, I'm not just throwing a whole bunch of vegetables in my cart like I used to and then putting them in my usable bag, but I'm putting them in plastic bags. And the other side of it, there was this wonderful plastic recycler in Portland that was turning plastic bags, as they call it, film, that was not recyclable through the city. They were using it to make pallets. And so all the plastic bags that I collected, I would bring to our local store and they would give them to this company and they make pallets. Well, one of the first things that went away when the pandemic started was the plastic bag recycling. So these are these concerns that I have. Like, a lot of recycling has really gone away because of health concerns. And the plastic industry is just waiting to dive in and say, this is why we need plastic bags. As far as reusable bags have gone, actually, this was a friend of mine suggested this, and they're also suggesting this at Trader Joe's, is that you just have the grocery clerk load everything in your cart, bring it out to your car, put it in your reusable bags. And so that's what I've been doing for the last couple of weeks, which makes me feel like I'm making a slight dent in my consumerism.
Yeah, that's what we do at our local market as well. Just put the stuff back in the bag, take it to your car, put it in the cloth bag that you brought with you. And now they're about to change their policy where you can bring your reusable bag inside the store and bag up your own groceries with it. So yeah, I think we're going to get back to some more environmentally responsible practices as time goes on. But you know, it's true though that a lot of PPE is plastic stuff that is going to end up in landfills, and it's sad that that's the case. But the good side of it is that people are starting to make their own PPE where possible. You know, the face mask sewing projects. my wife Janet has made a whole bunch of them here at home with the sewing machine, and they're great. You know, they're colorful old T-shirts and things that can be repurposed. So that's nice to see. And just, you know, people staying home have gotten, I mean, some people just end up putting on pounds and watching TV. But a lot of us are using that time to do cool stuff, you know, gardening, bird watching, getting outside, exercising more actually than previously. That's certainly the case for us.
Just make sure if you're bird watching, you're not black and you're not in Central Park.
Yeah, right. Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I know a lot of people that are gardening, and people who have not gardened in a really long time or ever have told me that they've planted huge plots. In fact, I started my garden a month earlier because I had the time and the weather was good. And I realized I really would like to be able to grow my own greens. I don't want to keep buying them at the store. So I see that there's some resurgence of some of the do-it-yourself sustainable energy that I remember from the early 70s, the days of appropriate technology. So that's good. But I am concerned that there's these forces that are hovering around trying to take this all away from us. I wonder, is this a concern that you have?
Well, of course. I mean, you mentioned disaster capitalism earlier. I mean, that's not something we need to fear in the future. It's happening. It's all around us right now. I mean, the corporate bailouts that I was talking about earlier are part and parcel of that. And you know, I think what we have to do is what we can. You know, in the in the cracks in the sidewalk, you know, a flower grows. and there's lots of concrete all over the place. And so we just need to break it up, turn it into urbanite and grow some veggies in the cracks.
I'm starting to see that we are rethinking our relationship to so many parts of our lives, whether it's where we work, how we work, how we relate to our neighbors. And I wonder how that can become a transformative way to move ahead and actually to help us get through this pandemic.
It's been called social distancing, but I really don't like that. I think we should just call it physical distancing, because we need social connection more than ever. As we're more physically distant, we need to find ways of keeping in touch with one another and showing our care and concern for and interest in one another, whether it's through, you know, Zoom calls and using technology, or whether it's, you know, sharing our garden veggies over the fence with our face masks on if need be, or whatever. You know, it's in a way it's never been more important, particularly for people who are isolated. We need to keep track of who those people are in our neighborhoods so that we can be sure that their health is okay, they have what they need, and they're not miserable, you know. So I really look forward to the time when we can have maybe, if necessary, physically distanced, but nevertheless have block parties and celebrations together, because you know, that's what makes life worth living, and especially as during times when we maybe have to sacrifice together in order to achieve a long range goal like stopping climate change. You know, doing it together in ways that are celebratory and mutually supportive, that's, you know, we can improve happiness even as we're reducing our consumption. And that's, you know, if we had sound leadership at the national level, that would be message number one. You know, that we'd be hearing that every day, just like you know, during the pandemic we hear keep a social distance, wear a face mask, wash your hands. Well, we'd be hearing use less, turn down your thermostat during the winter, but get together and have fun and celebrate and enjoy music and watch birds and do all these other things that make life worth living.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Richard Heinberg, Senior Fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute, about how the coronavirus pandemic provides both opportunities and challenges for creating a sustainable future. Well, I'm thinking how one of the fringe benefits of this is that I've started doing all my interviews over Zoom, which I don't know if I will do this once we are back in the station. But in a way, actually seeing all these people that I've talked to on the phone for years, like you, is really pleasant. And I feel like it makes the interview, it takes it to another level. And I had a very interesting experience a few weeks ago. I was interviewing somebody that I'd never met officially, but we'd seen each other at hearings and things. And we were sitting talking before the interview, and we just started chatting, and then we talked for like 45 minutes after the interview. I had this new friend.
Cool.
So I'm thinking how I used to kind of scorn Zoom and people who were doing all this video conferencing and thinking it's really a distancing thing. But now that we can't get together in large groups, how do you see that we're maybe using these technologies in ways that they were not really conceived to be?
We're using Zoom for all kinds of things now that I think people never envisioned, like making music together. I haven't actually done that yet with my musical partners, but I'm figuring how we might get together for some rehearsals or jams or whatever.
If you can figure out the latency issue, that's the thing that would get me.
Yeah, right. So far it's not perfect for that, but there are all kinds of performing artists who have produced, you know, wonderful online work, rather than just saying "woe is me." They've gone back to the drawing board and found ways of sharing their talent with the world through these online platforms. And, you know, I think that's great. We got to use what we have.
I'm just thinking about some of the other things that we're learning about ourselves and about technology and about the physical planet, maybe, that are things we might not have realized before this pandemic that can help us to get to the other side.
We talked about declining carbon emissions. Another thing that we're seeing as traffic has abated and people have been in their homes and so on, is that nature has been coming back. And I think we've all seen the photos and videos online of critters just taking back space where civilization had been increasingly excluding them, and that certainly warms my heart. We have got to find ways of creating more space for wild creatures, because otherwise they're going away, not just because of climate change, but because of land use policies, urban growth, paving paradise and putting up a parking lot, as Joni Mitchell saying many years ago. And the people who really study this say that in order to seriously reduce biodiversity loss, we need to devote basically half of Earth to wild nature. And that sounds like a huge, huge tall order, but it's what's needed. It's like stopping climate change. That sounds like a tall order too, getting off of fossil fuels. They created our modern consumer industrial growth economy. How could we possibly give up fossil fuels? Well, we're going to have to figure it out. We're going to have to do it one way or another. Either we leave fossil fuels or they'll leave us eventually anyway, because they're depleting non-renewable resources. Same thing with nature. If we don't make more space for nature, nature is going to start taking away space for us. That's already happening with climate change, as there are more and more places on the planet that are just getting too hot during more and more days of year, too hot for human beings to even survive.
Or too wet.
Or you name it. So, wouldn't it be nice to live in harmony with nature rather than having a zero-sum game where we're constantly taking away space from other creatures?
Well, on the other side of wildlife, I've been hearing a lot about how rats, who are dependent on the food garbage from restaurants who are no longer open, are now ravaging neighborhoods. So have you heard about that?
It's happening certainly in New York City, but other places too.
I thought it was kind of interesting to think about our relationship to rats, which is something we don't want to think about very much. And of course, they were the transmitter of the Black Death and the plague and bubonic plague. So it's we have an interesting relationship with them too, and it's interesting to see how dependent they are on us for their livelihood, and how they may also turn on us if we deprive them of this thing that they've gotten used to.
Philosophically, the coronavirus pandemic is hopefully teaching us that while we human beings are remarkable creatures, we've got language, we can make tools, we're pretty cool as biological organisms, but we're still biological organisms. We're still critters that live within and depend upon ecosystems. And the coronavirus is a critter too, and we're its ecosystem. We're embedded within ecosystems, and we have ecosystems embedded within us. And the key to our survival is not going to be just flattening all the ecosystems that we don't like or would like to scavenge from. The key is finding ways to live in balance over a long period of time. And that means curbing our own power. We have extraordinary power as human beings. And that's physical power, just the energy that we use. It's also social power, the ability to do things and the ability to get other people to do things. We have sought power in all of its forms and amassed amazing amounts of it. But there's such a thing as too much of a good thing. Power is a good thing. You know, nobody wants to be powerless. Every living thing has to be competent at doing stuff. And that's the essence of power. But, you know, if too much power can undermine our viability over the long run. And I think that's really the core of the vulnerability of the human species right now, is that we have amassed too much power. It's largely because, you know, we've had this huge hit of fossil fuels over the last couple of hundred years, 100 years especially, that gave us the energy and the power to do so much so fast. But that power exists in other forms as well, debt and political power, military power. And our survival is going to depend on finding ways cooperatively and fairly to ratchet down our power so that we can live in harmony, again, with other species and ecosystems, but also with each other.
I'm wondering if you've had any thoughts about, like, kind of on a metaphorical level, ways that the coronavirus is really a reflection of human beings.
Well, it's opportunistic, just like any organism, and we certainly are too. And, you know, the thing is, organisms do have the capability of limiting themselves, and that's what happens in over time as human beings interact with viruses and bacteria. We typically develop a modus vivendi, a way of living together, and an infectious bug may start out as, you know, extremely deadly, very high death rate, and then as that biological accommodation is reached, it becomes just a childhood illness like measles or mumps that a lot of people get, but very few people die from. Hopefully that will happen with this. And, you know, hopefully that will happen with human beings too. I mean, if we're kind of a virus that's plaguing Mother Nature right now, hopefully, you know, as we get smarter, we will reach an accommodation with our host that enables us to stick around for a long time. And so that nature survives, we survive, everybody's good. Right now, we're sort of in the plague phase of our relationship with nature, and that's not a good thing.
Well, I've heard several people say that the coronavirus pandemic is really just a dress rehearsal for climate change. So I'm wondering, kind of to conclude on that thought, of do you see that that's probably maybe a very big lesson for us to be learning right now about how we're going to face this much larger issue?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if we can't handle the coronavirus pandemic as a cooperative, mutually trusting society with competent leadership, then our prospects for dealing with climate change are not good. So this is a warning. We got to get our house in order. We've got to get our act together as a society, or it's not going to go well.
So what is your prognosis? I think we're going to do it?
I think we have a tough time ahead. I think ultimately we can and will. But over the short term, over the next few months, I think we have some hard times to go through.
Where we can learn to enjoy wearing masks and
yes.
Make them a part of our identity.
Homemade masks, colorful ones.
Anyway, Richard, it's wonderful to talk to you, and I hope that you do well in this strange reality that we're living in, and I hope to talk with you again soon.
Well, same to you, Barbara. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Today, we've been talking with Richard Heinberg, Senior Fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. Because the COVID-19 pandemic has forced us to cancel our spring pledge drive, which will be going on right now, we are asking you, our listeners, to help us if you can by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership. We understand that these times are hard for all of us and that many of you are in no position to give away any money. You can donate on our website, kboo.fm, by clicking on the donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Alan Derning with Sightline Institute about how the plague brought the Renaissance. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with some music by the Jefferson Airplane. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and wash your hands.
If you smile at me, you know I will understand, 'cause that is something everybody everywhere does in the same language.
See by your coat, my friend, that you're from the other side. There's just one thing I got to know. Can you tell me, please, who won?
You must try some of my purple berries. I've been eating them for 6 or 7 weeks now. Haven't got sick once. Probably keep us both alive. Yeah. Wooden ships on the water. Sister.